on Monday, the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., we'll have street interviews. You can call in and give your opinions live on air about the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King. Listen to great gospel music and hear some of Dr. King's famous speeches, I Have a Dream, On the Mountaintop, and more. So tune in Monday, January the 16th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., and help us celebrate Dr. King's life. This is why we say we want to be your community voice and your musical choice.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's coming right up. We've got the Old Mole Variety Hour. And don't forget that at 10 o'clock, the food show is going to be here. And at 11 o'clock, Democracy Now!
I wish I was a mole in the ground.
And before we start the Old Mole Variety Hour, I need to tell you that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 16th. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is engineering. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. On this program, we regularly challenge and expose the malfeasance of governments and expose their leaders' worldview as a class bias distortion of reality. We attempt to bring into focus the possibility of another reality, one ground in the principles of equity and justice for all peoples. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Robert Polin, an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts and author of Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fractures and the Landscape of Global Austerity. Jan Hawken and Denise Morris, two of our regular movie moles, we'll be discussing the film Good Night and Good Luck, a film about the McCarthy era and the role of Edward R. Murrow in bringing McCarthyism down. Fran Michel does an appearance as our well-read Red, and we'll be discussing the Alito nomination and what progressives have to look forward to as the Supreme Court takes a hard turn to the right. I'll be closing out the hour with some observation on the Bush propaganda machine, after which we'll be hearing the eloquent words of Martin Luther King Jr., rebutting the propaganda tactics of another regime and another war, but which perfectly fit the present-day situation. Now here's Bill Resnick with Robert Polin.
Thanks, Tom, and Robert Polin, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks very much. I'm really happy to be on.
Robert Polin's the founding co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at UMass Amherst. He's an engaged academic. He's worked with the living wage movement, and he's written the book Contours of Dissent. It's about the Clinton administration and its hollow boom and betrayal of working people. Robert Polin, let me set the background. The Bush administration is in disgrace. The War of the Line, the incompetence, ideological incompetence in Katrina, a cronyist incompetence in Katrina, its ideological incompetence in Iraq and in foreign policy, the Abramoff delay scandals, the illegal eavesdropping, the very poor economic performance. It goes on and on, the absurdly expensive bureaucratic nightmare of Medicaid drug reform, huge budget deficits, declining income for working people, vastly expanding income tax breaks for the rich. The issue, it seems to me, is then why can't and haven't the Democrats been able to articulate a persuasive alternative? What's wrong with them?
Well, I think there's two wings of the Democrats. Democratic Party, there's the, you know, overwhelmingly corporate wing represented by Clinton and Clinton, John Kerry. There is a kind of labor left wing, but it's too weak. And so the corporate wing has long been beholden to interests not that different than the Republican Party. They do make gestures to the progressive wing, but they're mere gestures. That's a lot of what those chapters in my book are about. If you actually examine the record of the Clinton administration with respect to working people, it was terrible. It was only good relative to the disaster under Bush. So, and that's how they play it. They play it, you know, that Clinton called the triangulation. So, triangulation meaning putting themselves between a progressive agenda and the Republicans, and that's how they expect to win elections. So, it's very difficult for people on the left, even the Democratic Party left, to mount an effective opposition because they get swallowed up by the money Democrats like Clinton.
Mm-hmm. In Contours of Dissent, you though wrote about Clinton's awakening as president. I think the awakening came long before, but when Rubin, his what was a Treasury Secretary, is that what he was?
Initially he was head of the whatever they had a new. Clinton created a new office for him as the chief economic advisor, but he then went on to become Treasury Secretary.
Right. In any event, he told Clinton, "Look, you've got to satisfy the bond markets. They'll kill you if unless you make deals with Alan Greenspan." Well, you could talk about it.
You're right, Bill. I mean, I don't doubt for a minute that Clinton already understood these things. It's just that the portrayal of the story by no less than Bob Woodward himself, who apparently was sitting in on these meetings, where Greenspan and Robert Rubin, who had come directly from the Wall Street firm Goldman Sachs, basically told him to abandon the mildly progressive, mildly left program on which he won and got elected. They told him to abandon that in the interest of catering to Wall Street, effectively, and he caved in. And he knew he caved in. In fact, at one point, Bob Woodward quotes him as having said, "Oh, this is great." He says, "Now I betray the people that voted me in, and I am working for the bond markets." Well, so Clinton knew what he was doing. He expressed some displeasure about it. But nevertheless, that's where he went, and that's where the Democrats are. So for us to expect to get much out of the Democrats, it's not going to happen until there is a very, you know, strong left which pushes the reasonably good people in politics to be supportive mm-hmm. of a progressive agenda.
Right. Let's put that off for a second. I want to pursue, though, Clinton's awakening, his sort of realization. I think what Rubin argued, or if he didn't, is that if you don't play ball with the bond market and with Wall Street and with Alan Greenspan and sort of run the economy their way, they'll stop investing and then you're really in trouble. I mean, it seems to me it would be a repeat of sort of the Mitterrand experience or the Wilson experience in England, Mitterrand in France, long before. Was it Wilson?
The 60s in Britain. Yeah.
Right. Where, in fact, if you really try and tax them and regulate them and run the economy in favor of working people, which means they get less, they'll stop investing in you and they'll make life extremely difficult. I mean, even investment slowdown basically ends a Western economy, puts it into crisis.
Yeah.
So if you don't satisfy, I mean, they become so powerful and important, and they're so mobile, right? They can invest anywhere. They don't need to put money in French banks or U.S. banks. They can put them anywhere they want.
Yeah.
Invest anywhere they want, and, I mean, there's all kinds of games they can play.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem to me that Clinton went with the bond market and the corporations just because somehow they had political power or the whatever other reasons they invested in his campaign, which they did. But it's because, in fact, if you don't meet their interests, they kill you.
Yeah. Well, that's a very realistic assessment. That's certainly the assessment that came out of the French experience in 1981 with François Mitterrand attempting a very, at least for a year, an aggressive pro-employment policy and then getting whacked by the financial markets. I think that, you know, of course, any politician in any party, including Clinton, has to be aware of the real constraints that they face. And certainly the capitalists, speaking through Alan Greenspan or Rubin, were laying down some standards that Clinton had to follow, they wanted him to follow. I nevertheless think that there is room, more room
right.
for maneuver than Clinton or a Clintonite or a right-wing Democrat would say there is. And I think it's important for the people on the left who are want to be realistic. I think we need to be very careful and exploit, recognize where there are places where we can be effective and work with those and build around those. And, you know, like what happened in Maryland just last week when the legislature voted essentially to require Walmart to give health care to their workers. Walmart can't leave Maryland. Walmart is not a mobile industry. They can't say, oh, we're going to pick up and go to Mexico. And that's, you know, you're talking about 70% of the economy that is service-oriented. And they can't even go to India. And, you know, they... So we need to maneuver around those areas of potential strength and push an agenda forward where there is possibility for success.
Mm-hmm. This is KBLU Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Robert Polin, who teaches in Massachusetts. He's founded and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute. Writes a lot and has written a lot and worked in and advised and helped the living wage movement in the United States. We were talking about Robert Polin suggested that there are openings, that capital is not all powerful. Surely one of them is also the living wage movement that you've worked in. There's lots of room to raise wages for ordinary people.
Yeah, there's massive support for it. You know, I was involved. I've been involved, as you said, for a decade now with that. And it's won. It's won in 130 cities. And one of the most impressive victories for me was the one in 2004 in Florida when it won with a 72% majority. And that's Florida. And that's exactly the same election where John Kerry only got 47%.
Yeah, that was a ballot initiative in Florida.
It was a ballot. It was actually a constitutional amendment to have this effectively a ballot initiative. And, you know, the living wage supporters, such as myself at that time, were urging the Kerry staffers down there to have Kerry just, you know, get strongly behind it, even out of total self-interest, and just say, look, my opponent and his brother, the Bush boys, are against giving workers a minimally decent wage, and I'm for it. He wouldn't do that. And had he done
really?
That, I think the chances would have been reasonably high that he'd be president now.
Well, that's an untold story. I hadn't heard of that election.
Yeah, well, it is in Contours of Dissent in my afterword to the paper. So I have told it a little bit.
Uh-huh. And that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
even
well,
with the
you know,
polling showing that was very popular, and even without Florida business didn't really go at it, right? Usually the restaurant associations and the agriculture.
No, they went at it. You know
they?
What? I was down there, and I was we did a study, and I drove around to the editorial boards of the different newspapers, and most of the papers that I went to were fairly liberal because I was in South Florida.
Were promoting it and giving interviews.
Yeah, but every single newspaper in the whole state of Florida came out against the living wage. And despite that, it won with 72%. And Bush, of course, Bush's brother, and they were all against it. But you know,
72%.
Huh?
72% is a huge number.
Yeah, the idea that you know, so there's a basic constituency for social justice, if it's articulated well, I think it can be very powerful. And the Democrats, like Kerry down there in Florida in 2004, were afraid to pick up on it.
Yeah, you know, the that's undoubtedly true. And, of course, a lot of the left Democrats, you know, E.J. Dionne, all these people who are writing books on you know, what's his book, They're Not Dead Yet or something like that. And all they all say, look, when you look at opinion polls or even those ballot initiatives, so many people are sensitive to the needs of the poor, want a different a national health program, are strongly opposed to discrimination and want it ended, have vote for living wage ordinances. It seems to me that that's all of that's true. But if you get an election and really the big companies start saying, look, if you vote for this guy or woman, we're going to have to leave your state or your city because they're going to raise taxes on us and we're in international competition and we can't do it. So it seems to me that on all kinds of issues you can win where the biggest companies aren't saying jobs are going to disappear from this state from this locality, that you can win a lot. But when it comes to a real program of redistributing resources in a major way and dealing with, let's say, environmental problems and regulating those companies, it's very hard, I think, to win a vote.
Well, it is hard. I mean, even the living wage stuff, which, you know, I acknowledge it's something, but it's certainly not a dramatic change even in the living standards of the people that are getting the wage increases.
I mean, it's relatively modest. What was Florida's living?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say it was only $6.15.
Right. It was not.
Yeah.
I mean, if you'd have gone up to $9, my guess is those companies would begin screaming like hell.
Yeah, of course. There would be more opposition. But, I mean, now in California, they're talking about, you know, $8.85. But the point is there are areas where, you know, their capital isn't mobile. They will certainly threaten. And some areas, they will look. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, that the clothing and textile industry is, you know, is not going to stay around here. It's too mobile. On the other hand, take another example. If we really got serious about renewable energy and rebuilding our urban infrastructures around the principles of renewable energy, mass transit, and so forth, that's basically immobile. And yes, you'd have to subsidize, you know, you'd have to bribe capital to do these things, but they would take the bribe and then they would have to accept a kind of social compact that would give progressive forces more strength. And it's really up to the left, the liberal left it's up to the real left to push that, things like that, and then it's up to the liberal left to decide when they're desperate enough that they'll go along with these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I think the dynamic is. I mean, the living wage idea, I don't know if you saw yesterday, it was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. It was the cover story, how this is the new issue for progressives. It was a huge spread. And
it was very favorable, actually.
Yeah, and it took 10 years to get something like that.
Right.
So, and you know, but that's just one example.
Right. Let's pursue it a little more. Let me do another station ID. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Robert Polin, who did a book, Contours of Dissent, and has worked writing on and working for living wage and raising the minimum wage campaigns. Robert Polin, let's pursue a little. You agreed, basically, it's hard to propose policies that really go at the bond market and the big interests.
Yeah, it is.
And
hard.
It's very hard. But there's a lot of them that can be. I mean, it seems to me there really is a constituency for health care reform in one way or another. And even if you can't win every struggle, it seems to me a left can operate within all of the, I mean, just there's a multitude of struggles going on around healthcare, around schools, around national and local, engaging so many people, around income. The labor movement tries, even though they're in a very weak position. There's just, it's tremendous amount of struggle. It seems to me within those struggles, a left can operate, even if they don't win them, as you can win the living wage ones, or, of course, it's often for not a living wage, but at least win minimum wage struggles,
yeah.
Raising it. Even if you don't win everything, and if you, all you do is sort of develop people, there's tremendous opportunity for educating people to those alternatives. And should, my line is at least, should an inevitable downturn occur and actually pick up speed and move into something really fairly serious, then working people are going to have to start making choices. And then all that organizing we've done, it seems to me, is going to, might well be realized in the kind of movement that really could make enormous changes.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, this living wage is just one example, but it's one, and when I first got involved in it, the people, the organizers in Los Angeles got me involved, and they said, you know, just the term itself has a lot of moral resonance, and it's going to be good. We're going to put it out there. We're going to insist on it, and it's going to galvanize people around social justice issues. And I didn't see that at the time, but they were right. I've just seen, you know, the only way that you have a chance of moving forward is by insisting on things. And it's, I think, and I've taken some flack now and then from people on the left, you know, but I think it's very important for us to speak in very concrete, practical terms, even if it doesn't sound socialist, the rhetoric doesn't sound like something Rosa Luxemburg would write. I think we need to engage at that level and not give up, and we'll break through because we're the ones that are, we are the ones that have the principles and are coming up with ideas. And eventually those will filter through because they're right.
Mm-hmm. Let me challenge you. It seems to me that's absolutely right, except for the thing about having to really cut our sails.
Now, no, I don't say that. Yeah. I don't agree with it. I'm sorry if I gave that impression. I'm just saying stick to our principles, but also be strategic and think about things that mean something to people today. Like
right.
30% of the workers or more, 30% of working people in the country say they want to join a union. Well, only, you know, 10% are members of unions. So we should be doing something about that.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, what are the barriers?
Right. Just about the Rosa Luxemburg. I think if Rosa Luxemburg were around now, she would, of course, but she could say, she would maybe change her discourse some, but I think you can still talk about democratic self-management in almost every movement. You're not talking about the takeover and nationalization of production and all of that kind of language. You are talking, though, about democratic empowerment in every movement, and that seems to me a very sort of radical demand.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that if Rosa were around today, she would talk about it in terms that people can understand today, and I think that that's what we on the left need to do and take our movement step by step forward, and I think that's what she would argue for as well.
Robert Poland, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Okay, it's my pleasure, Bill.
Right, so long.
Okay.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland Community Owned and Operated Public Radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now in our studio are movie moles Jan Hocken and Denise Morris. Today they're turning their critical eye on the film Good Night and Good Luck.
In the early 1950s, the so-called Red Scare reached a fever pitch. Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy is well known as the opportunist who exploited U.S. fears and ignorance of communism, creating a hysteria that would result in the destruction of lives and careers in the name of national security. What is not so well known by younger generations is the historic confrontation of McCarthy by CBS broadcaster Edward R. Murrow, famous at the time for his weekly news program, See It Now. Good Night, Good Luck, directed by George Clooney and starring David Strathairn, chronicles the events of Murrow's important challenge to McCarthy's crusade. The film has been out for several months now, and with award shows just on the horizon, Good Night, Good Luck is getting renewed attention. Much of the acclaim has been focused on the actual filmmaking. It's a beautiful film, a kind of docudrama period piece, shot in black and white, and featuring jazz artist Diane Reeves as a kind of Greek chorus lending commentary on the developing events. As the film begins, we are given a long wandering shot of the guests at an awards banquet for Murrow in 1958. The clothes, the hair, the endless cigarettes and clinking glasses lead us back to the golden years of television. Well, not exactly. Murrow sets us straight in his acceptance speech. The golden years are riddled with programming that intends only to, quote, distract, delude, amuse, and insulate, end quote. And if we are not careful, television will fall prey forever to entertainment. Murrow believed that television news has a duty to challenge the powers that be, and he cautioned that the erosion of this right and responsibility was upon us. And so, in the tradition of good film noir, Good Night, Good Luck begins with a death, the death of television. I'm Denise Morris, and I'm talking with Jan Hocken this morning. Jan, I actually was kind of we came to a sold out movie theater, and we didn't even get to sit together. But I actually enjoyed the film more than I thought I would. Not without critique, but it is a beautiful film, and it does raise some interesting questions and. Great character, good acting. I mean, you can be entertained by a film like this and come away with something. One thing we've talked about is the contrast, this kind of stark contrast that are kind of the film being made in black and white is maybe a metaphor for some of these good and evil, male-female heroes and villains, and the past and the present.
And the dark ages of McCarthyism as well. The moment weighs heavily upon people and gives it a kind of high drama. There is a close in heaviness to it, and also that I think establishes the kind of heroic status of Edward R. Murrow, who is cast as in some sense misleadingly single-handedly defying and coming up against Joseph McCarthy and the House of Un-American Activities. And on the one hand, it is this incredibly inspiring account of him, and I think it's important to acknowledge the courage of people who have stood up and haven't caved in within the living in the belly of the beast in this increasingly commercially driven industry. But I also thought it went too far in casting him as kind of a single, almost too single-handedly a warrior for truth and enlightenment in this period of incredibly repressive darkness.
And, yeah, you know, two ways to look at that is, one, that, you know, the film, well, loyalty oaths were nothing new to this period of time. I mean, we, you know, in the most recent history, World War One, the time period around World War One, also saw an incredible purge and persecution of people for what were considered un-American activities and disloyalty. But the film being that, you know, we basically go three or four places and we spend most of our time in that studio. There's, of course, the trip to the bar. Scotch is a big popular drink, and there's a trip to the bar and then the banquet. But for the most part, we stay in the studio. And found footage or authentic footage is used to kind of give us a relationship to the outside world. And that footage is limited to this House of Un-American Activities hearings. Whereas, you know, it may have actually helped to contextualize things and to make Murrow not such a sole hero to have footage of maybe other popular resistance. I mean, I'm led to believe that maybe they didn't cover any of it, or it didn't exist, or you know, the footage didn't exist, or they just chose not to kind of use that. So in some ways, yeah, we're left to believe that there was one person at this time who came in and saved the day.
Bold and brave enough and articulate enough to do that. And there's always a question, I know we struggle with this on in the Old Mole piece, how much context is required of films that have a political intent and critical intent. And, of course, we're not asking for some kind of didactic lecture in the film, in the form of film, but it also raises the question of which choices are made. I mean, HUAC, there are no hints that HUAC had been around a while. It's as though it just kind of suddenly seized the country. Of course, there are other films that have been covered, the Hollywood 10 and the many who refused to testify. You don't see the struggle and resistance of people to testifying. It did include a focus quite a bit on a black woman who was called before HUAC and was denied she was ever affiliated with communism. The people who were shown to testify all disavowed, even Edward R. Murrow, in one of his most compelling speeches, where he was accused of knowing a socialist who dedicated a book to him in Britain, said, well, I'm proud that I can talk with people, to people with ideas that I don't share. I'm not a socialist, but I think it's important to have conversations with socialists, something to that effect. So it's a bit like the critique of the death penalty, where the moral argument is, well, it's so sad that people who are wrongly accused sometimes are killed. Similarly, it's so sad that people wrongly accused of being communists get caught in the net. And actually, communism was indigenous in as part of American history and culture, and was at the heart of so much, both the Communist Party, capital C, but also small c, communism, socialist ideas, were so much indigenous part of the history of movements and resistance. You still are led to believe that Murrow was critiquing McCarthy for paranoia about something that was out there that didn't exist, a kind of phantom. And actually, there was a struggle going on after World War II between people who were fighting for the anti-colonial struggles and for a different world. And the civil rights movement had taken off, so that it wasn't just psychotic paranoia. I mean, there was a clamping down on the real potential of resistance in the U.S. And all of that, of course, gets lost in that confrontation between Murrow and McCarthy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think, you know, what's troubling for real live human socialists who may actually go see this film is this idea, exactly what you're saying, that the threat was out there, but somehow it wasn't real, or it was real, but it was really about something else. It wasn't about imperialism, and it was it's very confused. But I mean, I think that we talked about, you know, Hollywood films and the limitations of that they are a product of what they exist in, you know. There's only so much that it will be done, and I couldn't and wouldn't expect that film to actually bring a real socialist person to the forefront and to humanize that person. There's one character whose ex-wife went to communist meetings, but he didn't know about it at the time they were married. I mean, there's just all this disavowal constantly throughout. But
Murrow said, referring, of course, to the 30s, alluding to how much of the 30s, the New Deal and the projects of that era we're influenced by people who are party members or fellow travelers. Well, you know, when we were young, we all were involved in some form of dissent. It sort of also places it in an earlier era of youth. It's kind of like getting caught, people running for office for having smoked marijuana in college or something. Well, you know, we all did that when we were young.
Yeah, mature people are capitalists, and the immature youth are, you know, these revolutionaries. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, we've often talked about, you know, how to understand the importance of these kinds of films breaking through the mainstream and how we look at them from the left and, you know, perhaps how we shape our criticisms and, you know, can we find something in them? I mean, would we recommend this film? What first comes to mind is, not to go too far on a tangent, but recently the recent release of the Walmart film, which is really intended to be a tool for activists, whereas Good Night, Good Luck is a Hollywood film that is intended to do what Murrow was fearful that television would do, which is to be purely entertaining. But it's intended to entertain. It's also intended to sort of tell a story and to also it does provide some context for the connecting the present to the past.
And also I think it drew out most effectively the wonderful pleasure of talk and commentary, because there's nothing visually going on with him. You just see this guy who's just kind of clearly a depressive, and he hardly smiles, and he's smoking cigarettes on each of his segments. But he's really thoughtful and this eloquent commentary, and you know, I couldn't help but kind of long for an era when, of course, this was not typical, but how the contrast between the trivia that is news broadcasting now, the banality of it, and that moment, that show that was not typical but still provided tremendous pleasure. And that pleasure and entertainment don't have to come in the kind of sparkle and glitter of visuals and quick shots. And I think that was one of the most, to me, kind of moving parts.
I agree. I really appreciated this film for its commitment to staying with the action, the scene, and not apparently, I have not seen George Clooney's first film that he directed. What it's called, but it was criticized for just being so over the top and so bang, 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 you know, cuts and movement. And, you know, and this film is much more steady, and it has a much more documentary feel about it. And I think in some ways that's probably why I did end up enjoying it. I liked that the camera followed the hustle and bustle, the labor, what it takes to put this together, the importance that it had to the people doing it.
It was sort of a hands-on craft of making the studio work and
right.
Minimal display of technology.
Yeah, and the technology was so different. There were probably a lot more people involved than there may be now. I mean, I can't truly speak to that, but there does seem to be something important about understanding what sort of goes on behind the scenes. And it isn't just the tinkering and the button pushing and the adjusting, but it's the actual emotional commitment that people had to doing what they felt was right. And I think the film does that well. There is the reporter also who is being daily attacked in the newspapers for being, you know, quote unquote, a pinko. And a reference to this liberal media conspiracy of our modern times, this is kind of a precursor. He ends up being kind of emotionally unstable in a lot of different areas of his life and commits suicide. And so that's a real human tragedy.
Although he kills himself. And
yes.
I think the film could have drawn out more the number of lives that were destroyed. I mean, it was like this guy who was super sensitive and went down, but the number of people who were in jail who lost their whose lives were shattered by McCarthy's, and similarly now, and I think it was clearly a commentary in the same way that Arthur Miller's The Crucible used the Salem witch trials as a commentary on McCarthyism. This film uses McCarthyism as a commentary on the current repressive kind of war on terrorism, the paranoia and hysteria of it. And I think in both cases that you can see this kind of repressiveness as only a kind of psychological hysteria and miss the broader context of what the interests are. I think there is hysteria and paranoia operating, but that there are interests at stake as well.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult. Consistently, this just brings up the horrors, you know, as someone on the left trying to stay positive, and that so much work is to be done in kind of bringing out are exposing the boogeymen of our times and connecting them to the boogeymen of the past. And there's so much that resonates in what we hear and what is spoken in this film that it is a little eerie. And knowing that a lot of that is authentic, it's what they said, you know, when you hear again the rhetoric about national security and the rhetoric about, you know, the threat, the fear, all of it. And that
if you raise questions, then you're an enemy and you're giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Even, yeah, the rhetoric rings true for today.
Yeah. And Murrow, at one point in one of his speeches, and we should say that the actor David Strathern does an amazing job. He says, you know, we must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. And that's an important message. I think disloyalty, though, could be understood to be many different things at many different times, and sometimes disloyalty is maybe not so bad, or perhaps there's a better word to describe resistance, but we'll call it resistance. Well, we got to wrap it up. I'd like to just close with a quote from Martin Luther King Jr., quote, "Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter." And I think that is both an important message for our times and a message that's central to the film Good Night, Good Luck. This is Denise Morris. I'm with Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've been talking about the film Good Night, Good Luck.
Good morning, good luck.
Thank you, Jan and Denise. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Now here is Fran Michelle, our well-read Red, discussing the Alito nomination and almost certain confirmation.
The good news is, even the New York Times, considered a leftist hotbed nowhere except on Fox News, recognizes the danger of Sam Alito's rightist views and of the imperial presidency. The bad news is, the legislature includes no opposition party to take action. Commenting on Judge Alito's smooth persona and dinner table geniality, Pierre Tristram on his website Candide's Notebooks observes, "Not to make exaggerated claims, but it's possible to be a crook, a hitman, a Jay Gould, or a Jack Abramoff, and still be a terrific dinner companion. Alito is not a boor in person. He's a boor only in his legal philosophy. It's all there in his past decisions, his speeches, his on-the-record advocacies, his infamous abortion ruling that drips of contempt for women, his imperial view of the presidency that drips with contempt for Congress, his John Roberts-like courtier's draw to power and in defense of power at the expense of the weaker, the ordinary, the individual for whom the Bill of Rights was written. Alito, Tristram argues, is just mean. For instance, less than 3 years ago, Alito's Third Circuit Appeals Court heard a case about a prison inmate placed indefinitely in solitary confinement, where he was not allowed books, magazines, newspapers, or pictures from home, only religious and legal tracts. The inmate, Ronald Banks, claimed his First Amendment rights were being infringed by not having newspapers to read. The warden disagreed. The ban, he reasoned in court, was not only to punish inmates, but also to keep them from using newspapers as catapults and incendiary devices. Apparently, inmates are into flinging fecal matter at guards with rolled-up periodicals and sometimes burning them. But if that were so, why couldn't they use the religious or legal magazines for the same purpose? Two judges ruled in favor of Banks, calling the rules unjustified, exaggerated, unsupported by evidence of necessity, irrational. In other words, cruel, arbitrary, unusual. Samuel Alito dissented, noting by way of evidence that the prison's rules aren't irrational, that they apply only to the most disruptive and dangerous 0.1% of the prison population. That should be worrisome to anyone who thinks that the law is not a matter of numbers. It doesn't matter if one person's First Amendment rights are being flouted as opposed to 1,000 people's. But to Alito, it apparently does, especially when the 0.1% are not ordinary humans, but the most disruptive and dangerous of their kind. That alone is enough to suggest that Alito sees such things as the Bill of Rights as applying in a hierarchical, subjective sort of way. He leaves it to the warden to decide how to apply them. The decision that Tristram discusses resembles Alito's dissent in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which is discussed, among other places, on the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money. In his dissent, Alito argued to uphold a law that required women to sign a statement notifying their husbands unless they met a fairly narrow set of exceptions. The Supreme Court subsequently voted to nullify the notification requirement. The core of Alito's argument that the provision does not constitute an undue burden is his acceptance of the state's argument that the spousal notification provision would only affect a small percentage of women seeking abortions. This argument is not only illogical, it's also wrong as a matter of law. As the plurality opinion, O'Connor et al., noted in Casey, the analysis does not end with the 1% of women upon whom the statute operates. It begins there. Legislation is measured for consistency with the Constitution by its impact on those whose conduct it affects. The proper focus of constitutional inquiry is the group for whom the law is a restriction, not the group for whom the law is irrelevant. In both of these cases, Alito seems to suggest that it's fine to violate people's constitutional rights as long as it's only a few people, and perhaps especially if they are members of disfavored groups. On the other hand, there is one person to whom Alito would like to give more power, the president. In 2000, Alito declared his belief in the gospel of the unitary executive, the theory that the president, as commander-in-chief, is sole judge of the law, unbound by hindrances such as the Geneva Conventions, and has inherent authority to subordinate independent government agencies to his fiat. Sidney Blumenthal, writing in The Guardian UK, suggests that Alito's belief in the unitary executive was perhaps the paramount credential for his nomination by Bush to the Supreme Court. During the Reagan administration, Alito promoted the use of signing statements, which have been adopted with the greatest gusto by George W. Bush. For instance, when signing the defense appropriation bill containing the McCain anti-torture amendment, Bush issued a signing statement reserving the authority to ignore the very law to which he had just put his name, in the interests, of course, of protecting the American people from further terrorist attacks. Last month, John Yoo, the former Justice Department official who wrote the crucial memos justifying Bush's policies on torture, detainees, and domestic surveillance without warrants, debated Notre Dame law professor Douglas Cassell on the subject of the unitary executive. Cassell asked, "If the president deems that he's got to torture somebody, including by crushing the testicles of the person's child, there is no law that can stop him?" "No treaty," Yoo replied. Cassell prompted, "Also no law by Congress. That's what you wrote in the August 2002 memo. You said, "I think it depends on why the president thinks he needs to do that." I think it's safe to assume Bush would again cite his need to protect the American people. John Nichols on CommonDreams.org quotes James Madison, who drafted the Constitution and later became the fourth president, and who said, "Of all the enemies of true liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. In war, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. War is, in fact, the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. The same malignant aspect may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war. No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. For the Well-Read Red, this has been Fran Michel.
Thank you, Fran. This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. It should come as no surprise that during the last couple of weeks, Bush has intensified his ad hominem attacks against anyone who disagrees with his war on Iraq. The Bush propaganda machine has never found a road too low to travel. From plenty government-created news stories in the press, to the Swift Boat veterans' attack on Kerry in the last election. Of course, an attack which Bush did not endorse. Yeah, right. Although my vote, under almost any other circumstance, would have gone to the draft dodger, I will never figure out how this draft dodger managed to win the super patriotic vote over a decorated war hero. But I guess it just shows how powerful his propaganda machine truly is, how low it is willing to go, and how gullible much of the American public can be. Bush chose Veterans Day to launch his most recent intensified attack on his war. Bush chose Veterans Day to launch his most recent intensified attack on his war critics, calling them deeply irresponsible for trying to rewrite the history of how that war began, and said furthermore that these baseless attacks undermine our troops and give aid and comfort to the enemy. Bush's favorite attack dog, a.k.a. Dick Cheney, in a speech before the Frontiers of Freedom Institute, a conservative policy group, said that accusations the Bush administration manipulated intelligence to justify the war were dishonest and reprehensible. Cheney called Democrats opportunists who were peddling cynical and pernicious falsehoods to gain political advantage while U.S. soldiers died in Iraq. Some of the most irresponsible comments have, Cheney goes on to say, come from politicians who actually voted in favor of authorizing force against Saddam Hussein. Now, I don't deny that I'm feigning a little bit more shock than I truly feel, as this type of propaganda is par for the course in American politics. But as some political pundit once observed, the real danger ensues when politicians come to believe their own propaganda. And I fear that this is the case with Bush. One encouraging sign to come out of all this is that even the mainstream press isn't buying. An editorial in the New York Times reported that Mr. Bush said last Friday that he welcomed debate even in time of war, but that it is deeply irresponsible to rewrite the history of how that war began. We agree, the editorial goes on to say, but it's Mr. Bush and his team who are rewriting history. Washington Post columnist E.J. Dionne writes, Bush pressured Congress for a vote on invading Iraq before the 2002 election, and the war resolution passed in October. The bad faith of Bush's current argument is staggering. He wants to say that the more than 100 Democrats in the House and Senate voted to support removing Saddam Hussein from power, thereby gave up the right to question his use of intelligence forever after. But he does not want to acknowledge that he forced the war vote to take place under circumstances that guaranteed the minimum amount of reflection and debate, and that opened anyone who dared question his policy to charges right before an election. By linking the war on terrorism to a partisan war against Democrats, Bush undercut his capacity to link the nation in this fight. And by resorting to partisan attacks against last week, Bush Olin reminded us of the shameful circumstances in which the whole thing started. That, again, was E.J. Dion writing in the Washington Post. One of the most eloquent rebuttals of Bush's tactics, however, was made many years ago. Martin Luther King Jr., in speaking of another administration and another American war, had this to say.
Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Yes, we must stand and we must speak. There comes the time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
That concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is our engineer. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Stay tuned now for the food show.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. I don't